especially when people like log in to listen to us, it's the first 5 minutes is usually us going, hey, we were just talking behind the scenes, and then, you know, we said all this cool stuff.
Is that true?
I've actually been listening to a lot of our episodes. We're going to have to stop talking about that after this week, because we say it actually quite often. But this is the first week where we're not talking about anything related to the show behind the scenes. And so it's like a cold start, first time.
Cold start. You want to hear something crazy? I've never listened to a single episode that we did.
Really?
Yeah, I remember I was in an Airbnb in West Massachusetts with Juliana, and oh my God, Larry King, that's what it was. There was an interview I was listening to with Larry King, and he said that in all the interviews he's ever done, he's never listened to a single one. Mm-hmm. And he said because he's just always focused on the next one. And I don't know, that just always stuck with me. I don't even know why it stuck with me. It's not like it hit me and I thought, oh yeah, that's really the right way to do it. I think it just kind of was a way to give myself permission to not be self-conscious about it. Be like, oh man, how did that go? How did that go? And just be like, yeah, it's published. Keep the cameras rolling, as they say. You know, so I've never listened to another episode.
That's really interesting. I remember hearing Johnny Depp say something similar about he's never seen one of his movies. And when I first heard that, I thought, how? Because you put all this work into the movie. You've never seen it? You've never seen one of your movies? And I got to say, as I've gotten more and more just into this job of creating content, I get it now.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple of things. One, like when you're publishing all the time, you do hit a point where you're like, there's just too much to constantly be going back and listening to everything you already put out or rereading everything that you already put out.
Yeah.
So I get that angle of it. Then there's another thing where it's like, I think I went through this thing for a while where I used to listen to everything because I would get really stressed out after recording and be like, oh, I should have said this, or I should have added this extra little note just so people were like really clear on what I was saying. I used to worry a lot that I had like made a fool of myself in the recording. And that's certainly still, there's definitely still a risk. Like, that could definitely still happen. But it happened enough times. And then I would go back and listen to the full recording and be like, actually, that wasn't that bad. Like, that was, I think I'm actually in the clear. And after going through that a few times, now it's like I almost get more emotionally exhausted by thinking of going back to do the replay.
Certainly.
Than of just being like, well, you know, I'm just going to let it go and I'll deal with whatever the consequences are afterwards.
Yeah.
But I do listen. Well, first of all, I listen to our stuff. For people listening to this, I currently do show notes. So I listen to all of it just as like a, you know, it's part of the weekly process. But no, man, I'm just driving back from New England to Texas. I put on a couple of recent episodes and, you know, this probably sounds egotistical. I enjoy it. Like I enjoy listening to our conversations.
Nice.
Not all, like we've got some stuff to work on.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's definitely clear when we put a little bit more, effort into prepping, but I'm not sure what that says for today's episode, but it's always a blast hanging out, and it's fun to watch the replays. But we actually do have some stuff prepped for today. At least I have something I want to talk to you about. I'm not sure.
I got your text message like 4 minutes ago, so I'm excited to see where this leads.
Yeah. I think this is going to be kind of a wide ranging episode. So we, every once in a while here, as a lot of people listening to this know, one of the main topics that we like to look at is writing. Like writing, writers, storytellers, storytelling, that whole craft. I kind of think that's where we're going to spend a lot of time today, but I'm not sure. But let me tee this up for you. So last week we were talking and you said you've been listening to Schwarzenegger's autobiography.
Yeah.
And I downloaded it and I started listening to it. And there's a name that jumped out at me from the biography, or it didn't quite jump. The name didn't jump out, but the accomplishments did. If I say this name, let me know if this means anything to you. John Milius.
Nope.
John Milius. Okay. He didn't mean anything to me either, but he was one of the most influential writers and probably of the last 50 years. And probably nobody knows his name, but everybody listening to this, or almost everybody, is going to know what he did. So I'll read some of his accomplishments in a second here. But the reason I wanted to talk about this for a few reasons: one, very interesting, very influential writer. And I've started looking into some like interviews with him. He's got really interesting thoughts on storytelling. So I thought it'd be fun to just kind of unpack some of his work and jam on it a little bit, get your thoughts on what he thinks about storytelling.
Cool.
But the other is that a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about history, and I mentioned that one of my favorite things about history is like when you start to notice the like unseen connections between big historical events.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have a good example of it at the time, but I think John's actually the perfect example of it. So let me read you what he's done. John Milius, the name that nobody knows, at least neither one of us know, but he wrote the first two Dirty Harry movies. He wrote Apocalypse Now. He wrote Conan the Barbarian. He wrote Red Dawn. He wrote Jeremiah Johnson. Did you ever see that movie?
No.
That was like a big mountain man movie. Wrote Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. He was hired to do a rewrite of the dialogue for The Hunt for Red October. Sean Connery asked for him specifically. He wrote Behind Enemy Lines. He wrote the monologue. Did you ever see Jaws?
Of course.
Okay. You know the monologue about the, you know, to those who inhabit the USS Indianapolis, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Those are his words.
Wow.
He wrote the opening and closing scenes from Saving Private Ryan.
Wow.
And crucial in the creation of the UFC. In fact, the reason that UFC fighters fight in an octagon cage is that was his suggestion. Wow. So this is a guy who is pretty much like Jaws, Dirty Harry, Apocalypse Now, Indiana Jones, Saving Private. Those are all the most important action movies of our entire generation. Like, if you were to say, what are your top 10 action movies that like shaped your life as a young man? I would bet you 8 of them had been written by him. And so it just struck me as so interesting listening to the book. Schwarzenegger mentioned him and he only mentioned a couple of his writing credits there, but I was like, but even the couple that he mentioned were so influential. I was like, wait, you're telling me all those movies were written by the same guy? And then I started digging into him and found all these other ones. And I just thought it was really interesting that one person could have this much influence on like the psyche of a generation and not even necessarily have their name known by most people. And so I wanted to, that was what hooked me. I'll pause there for a second,
but then
I started digging into, his thoughts on storytelling and stuff, which I'll get into in a second. But I just wanted to pause there, get your take on that.
The world is full of amazing, talented people, most of which we will never know. And what that makes me think of is that it's impossible to speak to everybody. Because here's the amazing thing about it. Even all of those movies, it still probably only affects really like 2% of the population. You know, and so I when I hear those things, I'm always reminded about the strange dichotomy of massive influence and basically being what's the word for it? Like non-relevant, you know, basically insignificant. And I think that's cool because it reminds me a lot to just write for one person. Because like if you write to the masses that like no, the masses are never even going to hear who you are, even if you're the most famous person in the world, right? Like, who's the most famous person in the world? Maybe Kim Kardashian, you know?
Yeah.
There's probably half the world's population that doesn't even know who she is. And that's crazy to think about, but it's true. And so it reminds me to always write for one person and to never write for the masses.
That I'm so glad that you went there.
Cool.
First of all, I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
What you said reminds me, I think about this all the time with like people who are big in our world. Like for me, Tim Ferriss, right? I've been following his work for 10 years and like I've read pretty much everything he's written. Well, actually, that's not true. I've like dabbled in pretty much everything he's written. I'm not sure I've ever read anything he's written all the way through. Mm. But big fan, obviously, very big impact on my career. And in our world, it's like everybody knows that name, right? And then you just go to like one of your family members, be like, hey, have you heard of Tim Ferriss yet? They're like, no, who's that?
Yeah.
Who the hell's that guy? So it is interesting. You're right. How, like influence is relative, but I want to like throw a quote at you. When you talked about writing for one person, he has a quote about this that I thought was really good. And for the people listening, there's a few reasons that I wanted to dig into this. It's not just because we like writing here. Although we do, and I always like studying how writers do their thing. I think it's a really interesting group of people to learn from, you know? Yeah. So there's that. But the other thing is, I think these days, a lot of people listening to this are going to be like, probably more than ever before, writing is going to come into play in whatever work you're doing, right? Like, that's one of the foundational tenets of this show, is that like, great writing is a lever for business. Also, I think a lot of people are probably managing writers for the first time in their career. There are businesses that now are thinking about content creators and bringing content creators on board. And he's got some really interesting thoughts about that. I mean, if you think about Hollywood and how Hollywood has worked for generations now, it's very interesting to see what this whole creator economy is doing, because it's actually starting to mimic Hollywood in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So I think there's interesting crossover there. And then the last reason, here's another thing, like a third reason I really wanted to talk about this today. I think a lot of people, because like, since a lot of people are grappling with writing sometimes for the first time, a lot of people are asking themselves questions about how to stand out and how to mitigate the risk, like the creative risk of being a writer.
Mm-hmm.
There's a friend of mine. She used to run a camp called Beta Camp, which is like a summer camp for high school kids. And it's really cool. What they basically do is they take all these like super ambitious high school kids and they get them to build actually revenue generating businesses inside of like 6 weeks or something like that. So over the summer, you go to Beta Camp and you have to like create an idea, refine it, find customers, build out the infrastructure. And the goal is to have an actual revenue producing business by the time you're done. And, I've had the chance to talk to them a couple of times. So every year I would come in for like one guest lecture and just talk to them about like content creation, how to grow audiences and stuff like that. And this year there was a girl who asked a question and I haven't been able to kind of get it out of my head. We were talking about the need to be authentic and like honesty in writing, and how like there's an interesting dance that creators play there, because you are balancing authenticity with showmanship, right? And like the ability to get attention. And she says, well, how do you think about honesty or authenticity and the risk of getting canceled, like for your beliefs? And I haven't been able to get that out of my head, dude, because it really pissed me off that young people, like I think a lot of people are worried about getting canceled, right? And that's understandable. I am too. But it really pisses me off that the youngest people who are like coming up have to deal with this as a threat, you know? And so I think a lot of people are dealing with this right now. Like, how do you be honest? How do you build your brand? How do you build your audience? And how do you grapple with this concept of potentially being canceled for speaking your mind? And what's interesting about this guy, John, is that he has written about all this. He's spoken about all this, and he's one of the most influential characters in Hollywood, despite being sort of like a pariah several times over the course of his career. So he was seen as like a threat to Western democracy in several instances, and he was still always able to build a career in spite of it. So those are all the reasons that I wanted to talk about him today. I think a lot of people are grappling with this stuff, but that one with the kids is actually probably one of the more important ones, because I'm like, it's not that I'm not upset with her. I'm upset with like the state of society where like our youngest and most ambitious people are coming up with this looming threat of potentially being shut down for speaking their mind about something.
Hey there, it's Tim, and I need to take a moment to tell you about this show's sponsor. It's a product called Hype Fury. When I was able to speak to Yannick, who is the CMO, one of the founding partners of Hype Fury, and he agreed to sponsor the show, I was so thrilled. And the reason is because I have personally used Hype Fury for the last 3 years, and it has allowed me to build my social media following and my personal brand to over 70,000 followers. I could not have done it without Hype Fury. And I really, really mean that. I use this product every day, and it's added so much to my business and to my life. So Hype Fury is a social media scheduling tool. It has three main features that I think separates it from every other tool. One, it allows you to quickly create content and schedule them. So it's a very nuanced feature, but it's so helpful. Basically, I sit down at my desk in the morning and I type out my tweet I type out my LinkedIn post, and then all I do is I hit enter, and Hype Fury schedules it at the opportune time on Twitter and on LinkedIn. I don't have to think about it any more than that. All I have to do is sit down and create my tweets, create my posts, hit enter, and Hype Fury does all the work for me. Second, Hype Fury makes it so that you can easily create threads. And threads have been the biggest value add for me in growing my following. So threads really helped me grow my following on Twitter. And those threads format themselves into longer form LinkedIn posts on LinkedIn. It's actually kind of funny. I made a video about this not too long ago about how, yes, like you want to create threads on Twitter. You want to be a thread boy, because I'd say like 80% of my growth on both Twitter and LinkedIn have been from threads and long form posts. And I wouldn't have been able to format any of this without using Hype Fury. And then third, Hype Fury is really good for keeping you inspired. So what it does is it shows you some of your most popular tweets and your most popular posts. And it basically gives you information. It gives you inspiration as to what your audience is looking for and what they most actively engage in. So you're never sitting at the computer thinking, oh man, like, what am I going to say today? What kind of content am I going to create today? It's constantly feeding you new ideas, new inspiration, and it allows you to quickly create this content so that you can continuously get yourself out there, continuously build your brand, and most importantly, turn that social media following into newsletter subscribers. So through Hype Fury, I've been able to grow my personal email list, timstodds.com, to over 30,000 followers. That's turned into a business within itself. It's really helped me grow the Copyblogger newsletter. We're at 110,000 followers right now. A whole lot of that is also because of Hype Fury. So please, this is a product that I use every single day. I personally vouch for it. You can check it out at hypefury.com, hypefury.com. And if you have any problems with it, you can send me a DM on Twitter, and I'm sure I can convince you as to why it will add value to your life. So hypefury.com. Thank you so much to Hype Fury for sponsoring the show. And let's get back to the episode.
Yeah. And not just speaking their mind, it's more dangerous when it impacts writing, because writing could spread much more than speaking can spread. I guess that's kind of subjective now, considering there's cameras and stuff like that, but it's still, books matter more than YouTube. And the ideas in books matter more than the ideas in YouTube, for the single reason that they're way more timeless and they're way more refined. Like, if you put something in a book, you've thought about what it is that you're saying. Mm-hmm. And so, and yeah, I mean, geez, I've just this morning in my newsletter, I, for the first time, got a reply from like someone who was offended. And in my newsletter, I always have the 10 sections, and number 10 is the final thought. It's just something I'm thinking of. And something I've been thinking of is that I'm annoyed that people are annoyed about interest rates. And the idea is that, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but the reality is interest rates are still lower than they've been basically for the last 40 years. And everybody is just used to getting free money. And the fact that you can read a newsletter on an iPhone is proof alone that you are in a more advantageous position than basically anybody in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And like, I didn't even think much about it, really. People were upset, and I was surprised that people were upset. So what would I say to that girl? I would say nobody can cancel you if you don't answer to anybody. And that's a way that I have chosen my life from the beginning. That's not necessarily something that anybody can do. And I get that. Luck of the draw, whatever it was, I was just born with a bad attitude. Like, I don't know. I don't want to listen to anybody. However, I think that applies because we talk about long tail a lot in the show, and we talk about the bell curve, and the long tail gets longer and longer and longer every single day. And the more people who are representations of themselves as opposed to representations of like a bigger entity that they represent, the more people that are in that position, the harder it is for this stuff to actually apply. Because you could just say like, okay, you might try to cancel me in this wing of the long tail, but I'm in this wing of the long tail where everybody still likes me. So it doesn't really matter at the end of the day.
Yeah. I think that's so insightful. I had said something maybe a little bit similar. I think you actually probably summed it up way better than I did. But what I had basically said was something to the effect of like, I'm not sure there is a creator who ever actually has been canceled.
Me neither.
Right?
Seriously, I'm so glad that you said that. Like, when has that ever actually worked? Maybe journalists have been fired, but from all the stories I get, it just makes their Substacks more successful anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Even Joe Rogan, he said he added, like, remember that? He went through that totally. Whole controversy recently. He says the podcast never been bigger.
Well, he was on Lex Fridman when he said that.
Yeah.
I enjoy Lex Fridman because he's really into like quantum physics and, you know, like communism and all the weird stuff that I'm into. but yeah, I heard that too. And so I think it's a very counterintuitive idea because it doesn't actually work. It does exactly the opposite. Like what's the phrase? There's no such thing as bad press.
Right. Well, we were talking about it last week too, that the whole concept of anti-fragility. You know, Nassim Taleb, I have no idea if I mispronounce his name or not. That's one of the things I noticed when I was listening to the last episode. I'm like, who are you talking about, Ethan? But I think Nassim Taleb. Yeah. He talks about how there's like nothing. I don't want to oversimplify this because obviously, you know, depending on how you get your money, there are definitely ways you can be hurt in public. But his argument is, for the most part, like as a writer, there's not much you can do to really hurt or cancel a writer because as soon as you make them an object of controversy, their sales just go up. And it's like, yeah, they might be an object of controversy, but if you're looking at like kind of the underlying scorecard of have you actually destroyed their business, it doesn't happen that much. The example that he gives is like, you know, what if he was to get in a fist fight with somebody who was famous, it's like, yeah, that might destroy your reputation, but at the same time, it's going to create so much controversy that like you, it can't help. It can't do anything but help book sales. Probably same thing happens to banning books. You know, I guess I don't want to go too far down that line because I don't want to make this sound like, you know, this is something that I am completely immune to either. I worry about the opportunity for people to like misuse things that we've put out there, you know, like especially with AI and deep fakes and all that kind of stuff. I worry about that stuff. But at the end of the day, logically, I know that you are still far better off building your reputation as a creator and building your income as a creator. Because it's going to be a lot more anti-fragile than other forms of making money. Yeah. I want to pause just for a second, though, to share some of his quotes related to what you've said, because like the things that you've said so far fall directly in line with some of my favorite snippets from these interviews with him. So you said before, you said, you know, like writing for an audience of one is like one of the most important things. And I hadn't planned to get to this until like later, but he was asked one time about whether he had ever compromised his ideas in order to sort of fit in Hollywood or like get these sort of academic script writers to accept his stuff. And here's a quote. I mean, obviously he's an extreme character and he leans into his character. So I'm sure there were times when he like, you know, worked with people in order to make a script work. But what he says was, and I like this a lot, never compromise excellence. To write for someone else is the biggest mistake that any writer makes. You should be your biggest competitor, your biggest critic, your biggest fan, because you don't know what anybody else thinks. How arrogant it is to assume that you know the market, that you know what's popular today. Only Steven Spielberg knows what's popular today. Only Steven Spielberg will ever know what's popular. So leave that to him. He's the only one in the history of man who's ever figured that out. Right? Write what you want to see, because if you don't, you're not going to have any true passion in it, and it's not going to be done with any true artistry.
That's amazing. I would put James Patterson on that list too. I think James Patterson also figured out what's popular.
That's probably true. But then again, when you write, what is it? Got like 200 books now. It's like he's taking a lot of shots.
I don't think
a lot of shots on goal there.
Yeah.
I think that ties into the concept of what you were talking about in terms of writing for an audience of one and how important that is. And then there's one other thing that I wanted to say. Let me see right here. Here's one other thing. And I think this ties in with this concept of being canceled as a creator. He was talking about a script that he wrote, and he said, I didn't do a good job. And I realized the reason I didn't do a good job was because in both cases, I was influenced by the people who had hired me. They said this, or as they said, put this in and put that in. And I went along with it. Every time I went along with something in my whole career, it usually didn't work. Usually there's a price to pay. If you think of selling out, you think of selling out, but there's a price to pay. Usually what people want you to do is make it current. They want you to make it relate to people in 2000. So that was when this interview was. And the guy, and the interviewer said to have cultural resonance. And he says, yeah, cultural resonance. And of course, that's always the worst shit. Cultural resonance is dead or is dated instantly. Wow. Apparently I can't read out loud for shit, but I love what he's saying here about how when you try to write something that's going to be popular in the moment, it's almost guaranteed not to work. Have you ever run into this?
No, I don't think so. There was, I feel like when we talk about these things all the time, I'm always quoting people, but it's because I've really learned a lot of my lessons from other people. It was, I think, The Alchemist, where he said, a wise man learns from his own mistakes. A brilliant man learns from other people's mistakes. And so I remember reading that thinking like, oh, wow, other people make mistakes for me, so I don't have to make them. And I remember there's always been like an internal battle in my head between Mike Rowe, who says, don't follow your passion, follow opportunity, which I totally believe in. And then there was an interview with Steve Jobs and Bill Gates. I think it was Fisher. What was her name? Something Fisher?
Sarah Fisher?
No, she's the worst of the New York Times. Anyway, she's a big tech journalist. And she talked about passion. And Steve Jobs said, you have to have passion for something, because if you don't, you will quit. And I remember thinking like, oh, that's why passion is actually important. It's because why would anybody want to do something that they hate? And eventually everybody stops doing things that they hate, or if they don't, they're miserable. And so it's allowed me to continue working on things that I'm passionate about, because I know as soon as I stop being passionate about it, I'm going to hate it. And I'm just not the type that's going to do something that I hate doing. And so luckily, I think that has helped me avoid chasing cultural resonance, because there's nothing about that that interests me. And so I think I just, again, like luck of the draw, meandered my way around avoiding that pitfall that so many writers fall into, because they crave being relevant in society among their peers. And that's just never interested me.
Yeah. That's interesting. I definitely get that from your personality too. I think there are some other crossovers here that people may have experienced. Like when I read this, what I thought about was social media marketing, right? Mm-hmm. And like, I think a lot of people are working, they're trying to learn that. They're trying to crack that code right now. A lot of people, I think, have seen the value of having some kind of audience. And
definitely.
There's a lot of people out there who are trying to build like a Twitter following. And for the ones that really like it, I think it works well, right? It's like all of a sudden you've been unleashed and you have this whole new way of kind of expressing yourself. And that's cool. And I think there's some people who don't like it. And I fall somewhere in between these two. But it's like they maybe don't like it as much, and they're trying to force themselves to do what they think is supposed
to
be
done. And you can feel it.
Yeah.
Even something as plain as Twitter, where on the surface, all of it looks the same, mm-hmm. right? It's just like another cookie cutter box of a tweet, one after the other, after the other. But there still is something that's so powerful about words, where you can just tell, you know, you can tell that the person on the other end of that isn't fully into it. And then you can tell when people really, really are. And I always feel like that concept is like a missed opportunity for the English language. I was thinking about this when your friend Steph, she's got that cool website about untranslatable words. And I always feel like there should be a word in the English language that says the
like the awareness of knowing that somebody else is really, really into something, because it's a feeling, right? Like, you can just feel when you're in somebody's presence. Oh, wow. Like, this person really is into this. Even if they're not super animated or whatever, like, you can just tell. And I always looked for a word for that, and I can never find it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I never thought about that. But even as you just describe it, you're totally right. There is something, I don't know, maybe it's like deeply rooted in our social background, but yeah, you're definitely able to tell. So yeah, I think social media is one. And like I said, maybe that one comes to mind for me because I fall somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. Like, I have colleagues who are, they love it, right? It's like, that's like a playground to them. And I don't dislike it, but it's not like, that's not how I would relax, or that's not the first place that I would go to share an idea. So I fall somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. I liked what you were saying about just kind of like focusing on what you enjoy doing. I'm not really sure. You said something interesting, which is that you sort of have always felt at odds between what Mike Rowe says, which I always love. He said, specifically, there was a quote from a Tim Ferriss interview where he said, "Don't follow your passion, but bring it with you."
Yeah.
Which,
or he says, like, follow opportunity and then learn to be passionate about it.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I like that a lot. I also tend to think that a lot of founders, and I've seen this happen, once they taste success, they start, like, there's kind of a halo effect on whatever their founding story is. And so you can literally watch, if you go back through enough old interviews with people, and you'll see their founding story change over time. And a couple of things happen. Sometimes the idea becomes much more obvious, right, than it really was in the beginning, or their passion for it is kind of played up, because I think as you start to experience success, you'll start to experience more passion for something. Then, like, I think about this for myself right now. I've developed a little bit of a reputation as somebody who's, like, known for newsletter stuff. And if you had told me 2 years ago that that would be like an important piece of my career, I would have been like, I don't care about that at all. But there's something about developing a little bit of a reputation for something or finding some success that makes it easier to have fun with, I think.
Yeah.
And it's that mastery type thing where, like, once you have a certain level of, like, competence, it's easier to have fun with something. And the way this ties in with Steve Jobs is, I think, who's the deep work guy? Cal Newport.
Yeah, Cal Newport.
I think it was him who wrote about, he wrote about Jobs specifically with the whole passion thing. And he actually breaks down his story early on and makes the case, if I'm remembering this right, that he wasn't passionate about computers either. Like, in fact, he got fired from, like, his first job at a computer store or something because he never showed up. And it was this whole thing. It's very much a case of somebody who learned to be passionate about it and either forgot that, or maybe he was never passionate about computers, but he was passionate about design, or he was, like, passionate about product. And that was, he allowed that to play out through computers. So I'm actually not sure those two are as conflicting as they may seem on the surface. I think maybe Steve's just been mythologized a little bit more than, like, anybody realizes.
Yeah. And I've come to the same exact conclusion, actually, because I've seen it in my own life. Like, all I ever wanted to do was be a writer, and I am a writer, but I'm not a writer in the way that, like, I thought I was going to be, right? But, like, I'm so passionate about it, because how could I not be? Like, I get to do exactly what I've always wanted to do. It's just, and I think that really is the missing link with what Mike Rowe says, like, find a way to be passionate about it, because the opposite is also true. You can be passionate about something that is just not working for you, and then it kills all your love for it. And I've seen that happen many times. I've seen it happen in the wrestling room. I mean, I can think of somebody right away, probably the best wrestler I've ever met. And by senior year, he was just so over it. Full ride, scholarship, everything. He's like, no way. He's like, no way am I doing this for another 4 years, especially in Pennsylvania at a collegiate level at Penn State. He's like, I'm not doing it. And, like, what a shame, you know? I think that road goes both ways, where in the same way that you can find a way to be passionate about a crossroads of what you love doing and the opportunity, life can also find a way to pull the passion away from a crossroads of what you used to love doing and an opportunity that you don't want. I hope I'm saying that correctly. I'm seeing like a visualization in my head.
It definitely interesting. You're making me think of a couple of things. So when you talk about an opportunity that you don't want, I think this makes me think about our conversation last week where we were talking about the importance of defining what you really want.
Yeah.
And how sometimes it's not really obvious and it's not always obvious why you're doing what you want to do. And I think there are a lot of situations in which somebody might like the losing passion for something can be an indication that you actually don't want the outcome anymore.
Exactly.
Even if you have trained yourself to like continue grinding through because you're fooling yourself into thinking that you want the outcome. But the other thing it makes me think about is this, other situation from the book, from Arnold's book. So he was talking about, there was a point in his career very early on. He had just left competition for bodybuilding and he was starting to get into acting. And the way he had kind of set his goals and run his life up to that point was very simple, very straightforward. I go all in on the things that I want to do. And maybe a year or so into acting, he had had, I don't know, like one small role. He was just getting started. And a friend of his came to him and said, you know, I want to make a documentary, the Pumping Iron documentary, the book that they had done a book called Pumping Iron, which had been a really successful. So he wanted to come back and make this documentary and he wanted Arnold to get back into competition and to go win Mr. Universe or Mr. Olympia again. And what was so interesting about that is like at this point in the book, you've heard how hard it was for him to go win those competitions. And he goes, it's like, I didn't want to do it because to me, it wasn't like formulaic. It wasn't a thing that I could just go do. I had deprogrammed myself to even want that life. Like he specifically says, he goes, how am I ever going to convince myself that having that body was the most important thing again? You know, mm-hmm. he built a life outside of competing, in that way. And what was really interesting is for anybody who knows Arnold, he ended up doing it. He ended up accepting the role and he ended up training and winning. And the way that he did it, and I think there's a secret here for people who might be struggling with finding that passion or finding a way to make themselves passionate about where their opportunity lies, is he removed himself from the equation. So he said to himself, oh, actually, this is not about me and my career. Yeah. Yeah. He said, this is about all the things that bodybuilding has given to me. And like, I owe the sport this one last sort of thing, which is going to make it, it's going to put it in the spotlight. It's going to normalize it. So all these other generations of bodybuilders who are coming up and like fighting for reputation, they're going to have more opportunity because of this film. So that was his reason. And I was like, that's so interesting because he was just able to flip it on and not just flip it on, like flip it on and become a world champ.
And won. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a great place to bring it back to the theme of our show. This has been such a cool conversation and we've touched on a lot of different points. But if there is a lesson here, which I hold very dear to my heart, and I was just having this conversation with my wife, what's today? Friday was on Wednesday when we were getting out of the car. Everybody, I believe this, everybody always gets exactly what they want. And it's hard for people to admit internally that they probably didn't actually want the thing that they wanted, or maybe they wanted something else more. Because most times you want a thing, but you just want to sit on the couch more. And like, here's the best way to example it. I used to go to a treatment center every Friday. It's like 9 years ago, I guess. It's one of the best experiences I ever had in my life. It's when I was kind of still just getting sober. I used to go to the treatment center every weekend or every Friday and talk to these kids and just give them some hope and be there for them. And I realized that every single one of them in there could do it, right? They could get sober. They could whatever it is that they wanted. Because I remember there were times where I wanted to pick up. Like, I'm not trying to make it too vulgar. Like, I wanted to grab a bag of whatever. And no matter how big the challenge was, I always figured out how to do it. And it could be like on the whole other side of the city. I didn't have enough money for the sun, whatever, snowing, fucking barefoot. Like, I figured it out. And I also realized that when there were times like with my wife lived in Boston
when I met her, and I was living in Florida. It was totally unrealistic for us to get together. And everybody can relate to the feeling of meeting somebody that you are like you want to hang out with them so bad that it doesn't matter what it takes. You'll stay up all night. Doesn't matter. You'll drive across the freaking state at 4 a.m. Like, you will just do it because you want it more than you want anything else. And so I genuinely think that for me, when it comes to writing, when it comes to publishing your work, when it comes to even just business on a higher level, when it comes to bodybuilding, anything, if you don't want it, you're not going to get it. And if you do want it, I'm talking about like really want it, where only you know if you want it as bad. Like, only you know if you're willing to drive 5 hours in the middle of the night to go meet that girl or meet that guy for 45 minutes and drive back another 4 hours, right? Like, only you know if you're willing to actually make that drive. And so I think that is like the defining factor that makes people successful or not. I really, really believe that because if you really want to see the girl, you're always going to see the girl. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was just having this conversation.
I like the way you phrase that, which is people always get exactly what they want.
They do.
Even if you're not aware of what it is you want. Did we talk about the whole Tony Robbins thing with like the goals you don't realize that you have?
I don't think so.
So for people out there, I've mentioned Tony Robbins now 2 weeks in a row. One of the like little life hack, you can get like, I think it's all of his audio programs for $95 a month or something.
They're really helpful, man. Tony Robbins is super gimmicky, but like he nailed the presentation. You know, he figured it out, and I've got a lot of value from Tony Robbins in my life.
Yeah, me too. Actually, can I show you something? So I personally think this is like one of the highest value, like the resources that's out there right now. And, you know, maybe there's people out there who hate his guts, but I personally get a lot out of like listening to him. I like his energy. And also what I typically do is I listen to him at like 1.5x speed, which is, you know, it puts an extra kind of zip in it. But I found out recently. Let me see if this will play. Hold on a second. Can you hear it?
Not really. I can kind of hear it.
Hold on a second.
I'm saying, well, where are you now?
There you go.
Because we've talked each day about this
concept of
having the ability to close the...
Here's a fun fact for everybody listening that I accidentally stumbled upon. If you take any motivational speaker and slow them down to 0.5x speed, they sound like your drunk conspiracy theory friend.
Gap. I mean, how do you create an extraordinary life? You close the gap between where you are and where you want
to
be.
The secret to closing the gap
is first be honest with yourself that there is one.
Is that the best or what? So now I listen to Tony Robbins sometimes at like 1.5x speed, and it's great. You get a little extra energy, and then I will listen at half speed and laugh my ass off. But I like his stuff a lot. You can get all his programs for like $100 a month, which I think is, I mean, they're like $300 a piece anyways. So it's a good deal. And I've mentioned him a couple of times. Why did I mention him? What was I talking about a second ago?
We were talking about what you want.
Oh yeah. So he's got this thing in one of his programs where he goes, even if you don't think you have goals, you have goals. Let me prove it to you. He says, close your eyes. Now imagine a 75-year-old man. And he goes, okay, picture him. And then open your eyes. Okay. Now tell me this. Did that man, was he able to squat 300 pounds ass to heels? And like 99% of people are going to go, no. And he goes, see, you have goals. You just don't. Like, you don't understand it. You don't know that you have goals.
Yeah.
Because what you're doing, whatever you're envisioning, like for a 75-year-old man, that's what you're headed for.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't actively control what that image is, because like I know a 75-year-old guy who can squat 300 pounds ass to heels. So it's perfectly possible. But if you don't realize that it's possible and you don't take control over like designing that outcome, I can tell you where you're going to end up. It's going to be whatever you pictured
a 75-year-old man to be.
Yeah, when you like default close your eyes. You have goals, you just don't realize that you have them. Which I thought was that one grabbed me by the shirt, man. I was like, oh my God. So when you talk that about everybody gets what they want, and sometimes you don't even realize that you have quote unquote goals or that things that you want, but But you're right. That's where you're going to end up if you don't.
Yeah. The analogy that he made, which I don't think he came up with, I think this is like scientifically proven, which also probably relates to Arnold and probably relates to everything that we just said, is you go where you're looking. So the first thing that they teach race car drivers when they spit out of control is not to look at the wall or like not to look at the tree. And everybody looks at the telephone pole because they think, shit, I don't want to hit the telephone pole. And so then they crash into the telephone pole because that's where they're looking. And so your goals are where you're looking. And most of us are looking at what we don't want because we're scared of getting what we don't want. And it's hard to look at what you do want because like the default is anxiety. You know, the default is like nerves and angst and defense mechanisms and avoidance. That's the word I'm looking for. And the trick is to train your brain. For me, I'm not saying I'm perfect at this, but I do work at it really, really hard. The trick is to train your brain to constantly think about what it is that you do want. So in the case of Arnold, like maybe he didn't want that anymore until all of a sudden he did. And then it was easy for him to accomplish his goal, you know, quote unquote goal, because everything that he did was looking in that particular direction to get there. And so that's been very, very helpful for me from when Tony Robbins said that, it made it perfectly clear. I have visualization sometimes when I'm in my head about fear and I picture myself crashing into the wall and I'm like, I'm looking directly at the wall right now. Like I'm forcing myself to go exactly to where I don't want to go. And so I picture a car. I picture steering the wheel. I look at the open road. I'm like, that's where I'm going. And that's, I think that's what it means to always get what you want. You know, like you always drive where you're looking. You just have to make sure that you're looking at what it is that you want.
I like that. I have similar practices that I think help me when I realize that I'm doing the same thing. So one that I've been working on over time is I have a document. Like I call it the like what success looks like document.
That's cool.
And it's just a running doc. And the reason it's a running doc is what I've found for myself is that if you were to ask me to sit down and just write what I want, I can't most days. Like I might be able to write one thing, but it's usually just like whatever I'm dissatisfied with at that particular point or like whatever I know that I'm working on. But I can't write like a full robust picture of my dream life. I for whatever reason, I just have a very hard time doing that. So instead I keep a running doc because what I find is that over time, little snippets come to me, little images, pictures, or I'll go through something and I'm like, oh, well, this is definitely not what I want more of. And so I will capture those moments and, you know, turn them into the positive and put them somewhere in this document so that over time I'm building like an image of what I think success looks like. And the idea is that I know it's going to continue to change as I go on because, you know, you're constantly just trading up, obviously, but it helps me, I find, to create a better picture of like what it is I want because I do struggle to sit down and actually just write that off the top of my head.
Yeah.
And then one other thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently, which people may find interesting for like their own like goal setting or whatever, is this concept that you act the way that you perceive others perceiving you. So what does that really mean? It means like if you want to be, I don't know, like a writer, then you kind of have to seed it in your head somewhere that other people see you as a writer.
Definitely.
Because we're social animals and our perception of how other people view us is like a very powerful driver of behavior. And the way they've actually tested this, and they would do a thing like where they would introduce two people to each other. And in some situations, they would say, hey, Tim, I'm going to introduce you to Bill. He already knows all about you. Can't wait to meet you. He thinks you're so cool. Like, he's a big fan of all your work. And then they would do the opposite. They'd be like, Tim, I'm going to introduce you to Bill. Hey, just take it easy. Like, I don't know that you guys are going to get along. You're not really kind of the same people. I don't think he's going to like you at all. And inevitably, the meetings will go better when you already think the person is excited to meet you. And the person, the other person, comes away with a much higher opinion of you in those situations. So there's like a little cheat code there. If you can learn to take active control of how you choose to perceive the way other people perceive you.
Yeah.
And I'm getting at there?
Absolutely. And you just act as if. You act as if the other person already thinks that you are the way that you think that they think that you are.
Exactly. And like Donald Trump was the master of this.
Yeah, he was.
But that's it. So, and then I basically take both those things and turn them into some kind of like daily reading. And that's it. You're just like programming your mind through repetition, constantly telling yourself, this is how people see me. And this is, you know, this is what I want. And this is like how people perceive me. And that's it. And then it doesn't take hold immediately, but over time, every once in a while, you catch yourself in a moment where you need to catch yourself. And that's all you need, you know?
Wow, yeah, this was a lot on this.
Yeah,
how did we get here?
Schwarzenegger's script writer on
one episode
Conan.
That we prepared for is the one that we meandered around the most. I love it.
But okay, so what are the big takeaways here? Well, one is related to cultural significance and how single person can have a massive influence on culture, even if you don't know their name. And then sometimes you still go unknown, even if you are incredibly influential. And like, if you're doing it for the right reasons, that's okay.
Yeah.
The other thing is related to cancel culture and like writing for an audience of one. I think that was one of my favorite takeaways here. Because I think it's something that we all struggle with in the creator world, but the world's better with like dangerous creators, you know, so much better. I mean, we're already dealing with this problem of like algorithms spoon feeding you everything you agree with. And
You're not helping anybody by filtering yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a process like anything else. We covered a lot of other stuff too. And people can go back and listen to the rest of the episode over again. There was definitely a common theme though.
I think the common theme was like, it's not quite individuality and like individualism. It's just embracing the you that only you will ever be able to be. Right? It's the fact that you're the only one who knows what it is that you believe in. You're the only one that can write the things that you can write. You're the only one that can say the things that you can say in the way that only you can say them. You know, like all the things that we talked about kind of stayed on this path of if you want to write something, if something is in your heart to be written, it must be written. If not, then it's not on your heart in the first place. Then you're just your guy that wants to sit on the couch more than you want to write the thing. And so it all really did have a common theme for me. And I actually, it was a meandering conversation for sure, but I'm coming away from this episode with that lesson. Like if something is in my heart to be written, it must be written. And I don't have another choice because like I am a writer and that's what I do.
Okay. I'm going to end this on one last quote from John, because what you just said ties in pretty perfectly with this. So the interview asked him about his Jeremiah Johnson script and said, you know, you wrote Jeremiah Johnson, but you weren't able to sell it. And he said, no, I wrote it for nothing. I wrote it for $5,000. And then I was offered a deal to rewrite a Western script for $17,000. But Francis Ford Coppola had this Zero Trope deal at Warner Bros. And asked me, how much do you need to live on? And I said, $15,000. He said, well, I'll get you $15,000 to do your Vietnam thing. This is Apocalypse Now.
Mm-hmm.
So just to recap that slightly, he was offered a job for $17,000 that he wasn't really passionate about. And Francis said, I'll get you $15,000. I'll get you what you need to live on so you can go do the thing that you're interested in.
Yeah.
He says, you and George Lucas, because George was going to direct it, he offered that wonderful fork in the road where I could go do my own thing rather than just rewrite some piece of crap that would probably be rewritten by somebody else. That was the most important decision I made in my life as a writer. That sort of steered me onto the path of doing my own work and being a little more like a novelist. Today, I see writers making the exact opposite decision, taking the 17,000 again and again. I see them always taking the $2,000 more because it'll help their careers. They'll get to work with a real big producer. They'll get a big office. And they'll be working on a greenlit movie that stars someone who's hot. They always take that job every time. Whereas I tackled an unpopular subject that no one was going to make into a movie about where the chances were really slim that I could pull it off. Wow. Here's the kicker. There was no book Nothing But Me and The Blank Page. And that was really wonderful because I'd followed my heart. One of the nicest times in my life was writing Apocalypse Now.
Oh, so, I love when it comes together.
All right, people, there you have it. Thanks for joining us. Yeah, and we're done. We'll see you next week.
All right, we'll see you next week. Peace.